Gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. Had a conversation on the phone this morning with a dude down in Dunedin, South Island of New Zealand, near Christchurch for those of the international audience. About HAARP facilities, and apparently there's actually more than just the one. In fact, there's two or even three in New Zealand. And he told me one other thing that I didn't know, and of course I haven't verified any of this, this is just what he said. He used to work for Investigate magazine, apparently. What was it? The Waihopai spy base, and Will, you're probably familiar with this, is in fact also part of a weapons targeting system. Yes. Did you know that, Will? I certainly didn't, not until this morning anyway.
Yep, I could say I knew that. And a couple of other things about it that I probably won't say on air, but anyway, yep. Carry on, yeah. Benny.
Well, you know, I was wondering to myself, it's like I'm in a both a privileged and a disadvantaged position. We got all this information. We're interviewing amazing activists, amazing researchers. And sometimes they disagree with each other. And there was part of an email chain last night with a heck of a lot of prominent 9/11 truth activists, and for some reason they decided to CC me on all these emails. It was Gordon Duff and what's his name? Galen, who we had on the show the other day. And, well, I found it very interesting. It's like they were having this discussion about what caused the demolition of the World Trade Center. And, you know, my take is I don't know, okay? But there's so many people out there who have all different theories, and they all say I'm 100% correct, you know? Like we had Dr. Judy Wood here who says I've done the official investigation of 9/11, the real investigation. We've got a 500-page book, 800 pictures. I'm 100% correct. We had Dmitry Kalazov, a former Soviet intelligence agent, saying that I have the 100% smoking gun evidence. It was a nuke. And we had Galen as well saying I have 100% evidence. It was thermite, right? They can't all be right.
Richard Gage. The point is, there are some base fundamentals we need to deal with in this world. Then hopefully we can work out the deeper stuff, and we have to work out the deeper stuff, otherwise they'll maintain their control. But it's just opening people's minds. If people's minds can't be opened in the first place, then all this conjecture really doesn't matter. That's the problem.
You know, I think you've actually got something there, Will, because I came to a similar conclusion. I thought to myself, who cares whether or not 9/11 was done by this method or the other? What really matters is that we care about the people that died and want to bring the culprits to justice. That's what I really care about. The method matters not. The only difference is you need to charge the enemy with the correct crime. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll be right back.
Around.
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. I may have lost my country, but I didn't lose my sense of humour. Well, then again, I'm sure my country just slipped out of my pocket. Maybe I just have to retrace my steps to see if I can find it again. Welcome to the show. Also, our very special guest joining us live from the USSA, it's Casper Leach from Time for Hemp. Casper, welcome to the program.
Hello, and how's life in your slice of heaven today?
I don't know, it's probably the same as yours, overrun with Bankster cockroaches. How about you?
My place is overrun with some amazing bud to smoke.
Oh, mate. Well, you know, there are worse fates, because weed will get you through times of no money better than money will get you through times with no weed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know that from first-hand experience.
Now, can I ask you, Casper, what actually kind of woke you up and made you want to start doing the radio show Time for Hemp and campaigning for the cannabis, basically?
Well, my involvement with Jack Hare, I became the father of marijuana TV by putting together the television series Time for Hemp back in the 1990s, and it made its debut January 5th, 1991. And over the years, as our medium has changed, when Internet became popular, I started taking the series and using it as a podcast to put a spotlight on hardworking activists from all around the world. Then AmericanFreedomRadio.com liked the program and picked it up, and it became part of their schedule, and that's how it all began.
Yeah. Well, this is the one thing that I like about American Freedom Radio. I mean, least of all, they gave me my show. but it's more the fact that, you know, if you do good stuff, and, you know, nobody appreciates it outside of actually giving you another platform to do it, that's where American Freedom Radio comes in. It's like, it's just so freaking awesome, quite frankly. And, you know, I'm not being paid to say that. I actually believe it. It was just the difference between American Freedom Radio show host and, say, hosts of, I don't know, CBS or Radio Live that we got here in New Zealand, is they actually get paid to do all of this kind of stuff. Now, we can talk about the compromises people have to make in order to fund their operations all we want. But the fact of the matter is, Casper, is that without an outlet, you're basically pushing it uphill.
Yes, really, that's true. I was, I don't know how many people listen now. The studio, I think, estimates about 1 million, but at the time I was doing my private podcast, which I still do on timeforhemp.com, and that's the number four, I had about 480,000 people that was downloading each show that I would put up, and I put up about one a week. And now I do 5 shows a week live, and we're reaching a whole lot more, and I still do my podcast on my website, so... Yeah, you're absolutely right. They do help raise the voice of truth, and I'm very lucky to be part of their team.
Yeah. Well, it's part of a growing web, essentially worldwide, of activist radio, and essentially, I think mainstream media is in retreat right now on topics like the drug war. We have so much positive information being dispensed out to the public, if you'll pardon the pun. But, you know, on the one hand, I understand that the war on drugs is an absolute fraud, and, you know, you'd have to be somewhat retarded or been sampling 10 times too much of a good thing in order to think that the drug war makes sense, right?
Right.
You know, it's like the status quo is insanity, is what the term pathocracy, the ruling insane kind of thing.
And I'm
wondering, you know, are we going to ever approach a frickin' tipping point? Because, you know, normal and the campaign to legalize cannabis and liberalize these laws have been going for what, decades now, and still I mean I can't point a stick at. Here's the huge chunk of success that we've had. It's kind of like more like drips and drabs, you know, like, for example, dispensaries opening up for medical patients in California and a whole bunch of states allowing that to happen. But as far as it becoming legal, doesn't happen. And in fact, there's an article just came out recently, Casper, and you may have heard of this one, where the DEA is going to legalize the use of cannabis, but only for big pharma.
Yeah, I saw that article a couple of days ago. And I'm not surprised, because we do have the best government and protection money can buy.
Yeah, kind of like Blackwater.
Yeah, pretty much.
And incidentally, you know, people get shot in the back as well in the drug war. And, you know, I was wondering if we've got like a media contingent out there, you know, advocating for cannabis users' rights and things of that nature, like Time for Hemp. Is it part of a alternative media revolution? Because I think that every single topic that we discuss on our show, at least, is kind of like relatively unknown. And if it is known, it's only by a select few people, like truthers and activists and people who actually give a flying F about where their country's going, for that matter, instead of just drinking beer and watching football.
That's a lot how it is here, even with this topic, and it's agitating for those of us who are in the hemp movement, because we figure it should be common knowledge, or at least by now, after 20 years of us preaching, at least 80% of the population should have their mind around the fact that you can make 20 barrels of oil for every acre that's grown for oil using this wonderful plant, and we can save 20 acres of trees as well. We use it for paper pulp. We're able to create all types of great plastics and wood types of products that made from the core and from the stem of this plant. We can build an entire house out of this plant. Henry Ford's got a car, the hemp car, with the auto bodies made out of hemp seed oil, and the engine runs off of fuel made from the hemp seed. But we're still finding that when you walk up to the general Joe public and say, excuse me, did you know this information about marijuana? They go, really? No, man, that's wild. Dude, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So, Casper, I've just been looking into this myself quite a lot of, like, the health benefits of hemp oil and perhaps and cannabinoid receptors on the brain and endocannabinoids versus phytocannabinoids. And it is amazing stuff, and it is a shame that it's not more widely known. How do you separate yourself from being seen as a pothead?
I don't.
Well, that's straight
I
up.
I don't. There we go. Well, I mean, yeah. Straight up, I mean, I hate it when people say, well, the only reason why you want to re-legalize it is so that you can smoke it, brother. And let me tell you, brother, we're smoking it anyway.
Nothing's stopping you from doing that at the
Right. The only reason why we want to re-legalize it is because we want to start making 20 barrels of oil out of every acre that we grow and stop being dependent on foreign oil. And the only reason why we want to re-legalize it is so medical patients can have easy access to it without going to jail. And we want to re-legalize it so we can start pissing away all the money that's going into the court systems and into housing people for touching a plant, and on and on and on. I mean, there's that list. And when some people say, oh, so you admit to being a pothead? I say, well, no, I admit to being a marijuana user. Now, somebody's term of pothead is somebody who is probably like Tommy Chung in a bad movie, you know, walking around stupid, lost, you know, pretending to be really out there. And we tell people that there are two kinds of smokers. There's the average, intelligent, and up smoker, and then there's the stupid smoker. But either way, whether you're smoking pot or not, it doesn't change your IQ. It might make it easier to see, but it doesn't change it.
There are smart and stupid people in all sectors.
A friend of mine, he was in fact doing a biological paper, and he was given free rein to study whatever biology or effect on the body of whatever he wants. So he chose cannabis and the human brain. And what he found is that it decreases short-term memory, but actually increased IQ. So you'd be able to come up with all these incredible ideas, but you just wouldn't be able to remember them.
Right. Well, and then the other aspect of it is that there's a chemical in your brain that remains dormant until THC is introduced. And it's a chemical that your brain actually needs to function properly and to survive well. And so when you smoke marijuana a couple of times a week, it's the same effect as when you have a couple of glasses of wine a week or a shot of whiskey every couple of days. Your body reacts to it in a positive way. And And then also the other aspect, too, when people go, well, you know, the reason why you want to re-legalize it is so that you can get high. Again, I remind them that I do get high, but not only do I get high, but I paid for this from a farm that was from Mexico or from somebody's basement. That no taxes was paid on this crop, and no one expected this crop to make certain that there wasn't anything unhealthy on it for me to smoke. And instead of the farmer down the street making money off of it so he could send his kids to school or pay for his mortgage, I'm supporting a family in Mexico. So what we need to do is to re-legalize this so that, like liquor, I have to show an ID so someone under the age of 21 cannot have access to it. And when I make the purchase, my government, I hate to see it go broke, it can have its share of taxes on it. And then when I take it home to consume it, I can make certain that what I'm consuming doesn't have epiquat on it or some kind of poisonous bug spray that's going to make me sick and cause me have problems down the road with my lungs. So, yeah,
exactly.
Because I am a pothead. Right. So. I do want it legalized.
Well, you can make it a lot safer, is what I was going to say. If you can farm it en masse, I mean, it can be a lot more easily regulated, I suppose, from a health perspective to make sure.
I'm exporting those jobs overseas or forcing them underground, where if it was legal, then my local farmer would have a cash crop to keep him in business so he could also help maybe offset the cost of tomato or corn. That seems to be skyrocketing because we're spending so much money on oil right now.
And you take the power, away from all the wannabe gangsters who are pushing the stuff too. The gangs.
Yep, you sure do. That means that if that were to happen, if we were to end this prohibition, then the black market would be able to sell hookers and assassinations.
But I mean, okay, well,
there was a story in New Zealand. There was a story in New Zealand. I mean, on the safety aspect of it. I mean, the drug war. Basically, the police will spray crops or rip them up or burn them or something like that. And in one particular case, they sprayed a relatively large crop with Roundup, and we all know who makes Roundup. The fabulous Monsanto. They wouldn't hurt anybody, would they?
No.
And the growers then sold that bud anyway with the Roundup sprayed on it. Right?
My point.
So how freaking dangerous is this? I mean, if it was a legal market, it wouldn't have been sprayed with the Roundup by the police or anything along those lines. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, maybe then they weren't organic growers or something along those lines and they would have used it anyway. But the fact still remains, when it's an illegal market, you don't actually have any laws governing you, essentially. You know, there's no guidelines, there's no quality control, you don't even have to name what the product actually is. There's no set price per gram per se or anything. It's totally out of control.
Hence my point on everything. When you introduce regulation to make a situation safer, you only make it more complicated and dangerous. And that's why I hate the leftists. And that's why I hate big government people. Because
it's always
complicated.
And along with what you say, I find it funny how terrified law enforcement are of this plant. Because if you ever watch law enforcement go to kick in the door of a bunch of stoners, people sitting around smoking a bowl or two, or a marijuana garden, some guy who's like doing yoga and zen and then goes down and, you know, and works peacefully in his garden, these officers have such small testicles that they have to get 20 or 30 of them together. And then have to blow the door open with a smoke bomb and go running in screaming, no, no, like they're going to kill and shoot somebody with machine guns. I mean, It's not often that you see a marijuana a garden being arrested by one or two police officers with enough kahunas to knock on the door and say, excuse me, can we go through your place? Gee, we need to take you in. Because for some reason, they just think that the plant – is going to kill him, I guess.
They probably assume that you've got weapons to defend your stash, It's like, take no chances, and we're going to go armed to the teeth, yeah.
And they wouldn't need weapons to defend their stash if they were defending a normal legal business, would they? I mean, and no. The difficulty is that, and it's exactly true what you say there, Casper, it's like it's disproportionate levels of enforcement. We had a lady in New Zealand here called the Ganja Granny. She's like 65 years old or something, token up a little bit for a glaucoma, and then the police come in and arrest her and charge her for dealing and all of these other just absolutely ridiculous charges with zero evidence whatsoever. This is a 65-year-old grandmother who's a former nurse who's saying that the pharmaceutical drugs don't frickin' work, and she's just using a product that does, you know, let alone the fact that 87% of illegal drug users in the U.S. only use cannabis. So it then becomes a gateway marketing drug rather than a gateway drug itself, because drug dealers will actually sell cannabis in order to get more customers through the door so that they can offer them other things, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then on the other hand, we're talking about, I'm not kidding, I mean, police officers, they just seem to lack the backbone to enforce real crime, because here in Portland, Oregon, there's a section of town, I believe it's called Old Town, that is overrun by the gangbangers and the Crips and the Bloods and all the other gangsters that think that they're really hot stuff. And to get a police officer to go through that section of town and stop, you can't. You just really cannot. It's actually come out in the newspapers that even our own police department is afraid of going down there. They've had 3 or 4 officers murdered and killed. Of course, by making this plant illegal has created a false price on this plant that has allowed our gangbangers to sell this plant and also buy bullets to shoot at the police. But the police are afraid to go down to a section of town where there's actual murder, where there's actual robbery, where there's actual crime. But they don't hesitate to show up and force, you know, at somebody's door and kick it in and arrest them if they're smoking a joint.
Yeah, absolutely. I say protect the police, legalize cannabis. I mean, that way they'll have the ability, at least, to not get shot by people who are selling a few buds. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show. Our very special guest is Casper Leach from TimeForHemp.com, and we'll be right back after the break.
Look at me, driving and I won't stop. And it feels so good to be alive and on top. My reach is global, my tower secure. My cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out 1,000,000 vaccinations, or let them all die in exasperation. Have them all healed from the lacerations, have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison just because I don't like them. And I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command, because I can guide a missile by satellite. By satellite, by satellite.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the Vinny Eastwood Show.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. Our very special joint guest is Time for Hemp's host right here on AF. It's Casper Leach. Welcome back, Casper.
Thank you. I'm really enjoying being part of the program, and it rocks that you're part of the American Freedom Radio family.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it was there was talk earlier on when I first started on the show that they're going to have to rename it Global Freedom Radio or something along those lines to represent all the other international hosts or whatever, i.e. just me. I thought, well, that'd be pretty arrogant, actually, to rename American Freedom Radio just because you've got one host who doesn't live there. But, you know, who cares?
But no, but at the same time, you perpetuate the values and the concepts of freedom that we here in America built our foundational cornerstones on. And so maybe you yourself are not, but the American freedom concept is really truly a global concept, and that is freedom for all. Don't tell us what we can and cannot do in our living rooms. You know, don't treat us like children, blah, blah, blah.
Don't tread on me.
Right. Not unless I pay you $50 an hour and you're dressed in leather. Yeah, baby.
Yeah. Well, one thing I'd like to really break open here is that real concept of freedom. And I'm wondering, is the United States kind of like the birthplace or kind of thing of this terms of constitutionality and all of that kind of jazz in the modern context? Because I do know that many of the truthers and activists of many kinds here in New Zealand that have been influenced by American talk radio and television and patriots and all of that kind of jazz. It's almost like it's a resonating chamber for freedom of thought, freedom of speech. What do you think, Casper?
Well, it was referred to as an experiment when our founding fathers put it together. I know the concept of freedom and the path that we are taking as Americans and as a country are concepts and dreams that our ancestors had when they were enslaved, just may not have been able to have put them into theory and then put them into action. So I don't think Americans actually can take credit to say that the concept of freedom and the way that we are pursue it is our own invention. But I do believe that the way our government until these past 20 years has allowed us to pursue our freedoms has been a unique experiment in government and working as a society, and one that has proven to be an excellent model for the world to follow, because as free people, we are more apt to be more productive and more loving and less of a victim in so many different situations and commit less atrocities than when we are enslaved by monsters.
Enslaved by monsters. Now, speaking of monsters, I just listened to an interview today with C.K. Lewis. You know, you familiar with the comedian C.K. Lewis?
No.
No? Oh, well, anyways, co-hosting a show with some other dude in New York, I believe, and they were interviewing Donald Rumsfeld, and he just flat out asked Donald Rumsfeld, "Are you a lizard?" And interestingly enough, Donald Rumsfeld doesn't deny it. You know, just freaking hilarious. He's just kind of doing it sort of as a joke. He just keeps repeating the question, "Are you a lizard? Are you a lizard?" And Rumsfeld refuses to deny it.
Well, maybe it's because he can't.
Yeah. And that's what he said towards the end of the interview after Rumsfeld had hung up the phone. It's like, I don't know, maybe it's part of their lizard brain mechanism or something like that. They can't directly deny that they're a lizard.
Well, I can tell you, I have interviewed nothing but a politician on my show before. Barney Frank, I really like him and enjoy him. He's been a guest on my series, but even though he has a pro marijuana bill on the congressional floor, and he has been a champion of the marijuana movement, and that's why, of course, I had him on as a guest. Whenever I wanted to ask anything off topic, I got the answer he had decided he was going to give before he picked up the phone to everything. So, you know, if I could have said, "Why did you take your mother to the nursing home and get her drunk and push her off the ledge?" And he would have said, "The reason why we're working to get this congressional bill through on the floor is," you know. So I've learned with politicians, they know what they're going to say before you even call them.
Well, yeah, I mean, I won a speech competition when I was 15. You know, I won the senior speech competition at my high school, and I came to realize the concept of who would actually be the most successful people at swaying crowds and things of that nature. It's the people who had all of it pre-prepared and well practiced, and that was it. You didn't necessarily even have to have a good speech or be talking about a good message or something along those lines. All you had to do was deliver it well, and people just roll over and love it. And I found that very interesting, because this is what politics really has become about. It's now form over substance. All of these political scumbag filth have no credibility to my mind whatsoever. And yet, people still keep listening to them and also keep voting for them.
Right. And people ask me, what do I think the difference between a politician and a candidate is? Well, a politician is like we were talking. I mean, they're going to come and talk about pro-abortion rights on your show, even if your show is all about marijuana. So no matter what you ask, they're going to take it right back to pro-abortion. Now, a candidate, someone who is a political candidate, is someone who will answer your questions. A politician is someone who will never answer your questions and will only speak at you.
Yeah, I find that absolutely true, which is why in the age of YouTube and the power of the camera is now overcoming the power of the gun, just like the power of the pen overcame the power of the sword. And, you know, when you point a I say this a lot, but, you know, I'll say it again. When you point a camera at a politician, you ask a tough question, they give typically one of three answers. One, they dodge the question, which means they're dodgy. Two, they lie about it, which means they're dodgy. Or three, they tell the truth, and so then you can realize them as an ally. And I find it this would be a great project to do, Casper, don't you think, is to ask each and every politician that you can find tough questions just to see and line all their ducks up and see which are total freaking scum who aren't going to answer our questions and not serve our interests, and get them the heck out of there. You know, let's get out these freaking incumbents. I'm so sick of career politicians being in the game for like decades or something along those lines, and they never change their freaking tune.
Wow, you swear more on your show than I do on mine.
But he's not smoking enough, obviously.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It's the dry season.
I feel ill at ease, like just painting somebody with the broad brush of dickhead. That's all. But
I mean, how about this? I mean, let me play devil's advocate here. I feel like I always have to. I don't. How about the argument that people don't need drugs to discover themselves, to elevate themselves, to better themselves, to mellow themselves? And what about that? What about that principle? What about that philosophy? I mean, do we need drugs? I'm not even calling marijuana a drug. It may just be a part of our diet. That's
well,
necessary.
I don't know. I've heard so many Zen and religious masters and so many people who have studied various types of ancient rituals decry the need for that, pointing out that it's true in all species. That's why cats love catnip. And even back in the Hindu ages and when we were dealing with the old Oriental religions, this plant and a few other plants were considered sacred herbs that when you would utilize them would put you in commune with your Lord.
And not to mention, there's also a tribe in the Amazon that figured out, and there's two separate plants. Either one of them, if you take them by themselves, they don't do anything whatsoever. But combine them, and you have these huge hallucinogenic effects, and people you use them as spirit quest guides and things along those lines. And there were shaman in the tribes who would guide people on these quests, and they find themselves through these experiences. So, you know, it's the concept of you can reach upper levels and everything without drugs. While I believe it is valid, I think that it's to throw away drugs and all of their useful abilities in order to advance or open up different pathways, channels in the mind, things of that nature, is simply in what would you call it? It just doesn't fit with human history.
Well, and that wasn't the direction quite I was going. The direction I wanted to complete with was that we have discovered that as a species, it is our nature to not only experience this type of communion with this plant. That's what this plant is here for. And it is actually part of our society. I mean, if you look at this plant, it creates 50,000 different products. All of our creature comforts, our fuel, our food, our clothing, our paper, our fibers, our plastics can all be created out of this one plant. And then when you get done with that, you can smoke it, and then your brain chemicals get in line, and it helps make you feel healthier, and it brings all these great things into your system that makes your body even more strong. You can eat it and consume it, and it makes you even stronger and better. And so I believe that this plant was designed to be consumed in all ways, not just in smoke and food, but the ways that we still are now outlawing, consumed in our creature comforts as well.
You mentioned before the ancient religions using it in ritual and whatnot, and that is kind of where I was getting at. The powers that be are kind of into these mind manipulators because they believe their pathways outside this 3D world, and that, you know, that's what yoga is about too. It's a basic principle of ascension and the ascension from the material body and becoming this godlike creature and manifesting your own destiny and everything else. Marijuana is seen in a lot of the ancient texts as a pathway to that.
Yep.
What do you think about
that? And again, the ultimate creator, if I was going to create a child and leave my child in an environment that I could not interact with, and I had to leave my child there, I would leave my child as best prepared as I could. And it's almost as if the creator gave us this plant and a few other plants in specific to make certain that if we consume them the way they should be and use them the way they can be, everything we need would come from those plants, and we would not need to dig up the heck out of the bottom of the ocean floor, and we wouldn't need to pollute the air with so many different things, and we wouldn't be able to have all these wars and have a reason to be lying to each other and all the things that come with chasing after the oil. So,
well, you know, getting on to that topic in particular, it's the funny thing that our current lifestyle, in every sense of the word, is petroleum-based. And because hemp can basically replace almost every product that we're using from oil-based products at the moment, well, I wonder if the oil industry has a hand in all of this and keeping hemp illegal. I mean, that's just a conspiracy theory on my part, but they certainly have a good reason to make sure that it's never legalized.
Well, I know they had a good reason to push it into that direction, but then it became a monster and a beast all into itself to where they didn't have to continue to focus on keeping it outlawed. By outlawing it, two things happened. More and more laws against it were created over the years, and more dollars were accumulated by the oil industry, making them wealthier and wealthier and harder to compete against. Because even now, if hemp was brought onto the open market and we were to use it in America, we'd have to also have to have certain pumps now at gas stations made available to people. We'd have to do a lot of changes in a lot of areas of our lives at first to make that happen, and that brings dollars into the picture. And so now the oil industry is thinking, oh, well, even if they discover the truth, to correct it would cost them more money than to keep going with the mistake.
That's right. To the oil industry and the masters of the world, dollars make a lot more sense than reality. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. Our very special guest is Casper Leach from Time for Hemp radio program right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And we'll be right back after the break. Welcome back. Final segment of the first hour here on the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're joined by our very special guest from Time for Hemp. It's Casper Leach at timeforhemp.com. That's with the number 4, by the way. Casper, thank you for taking time for the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
It has been fun. I tell you, I've enjoyed your program since you've come on to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and I'm having a blast today, so thank you so much for making me part of your family as well. And let's let people know that you will be joint host on Time for Hemp Friday the 11th. I think that's going to be Saturday morning where you're at, the 12th. And that'll be 7 a.m. your time. And then again, of course, American Freedom Radio does have archives. So if you miss any of these programs, whether it be mine or Vinny's, don't forget to go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, check out the archives, and download the shows you've missed.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the difficulties with live radio. And I often ask people to listen to the show, and they don't bother because they think they have to tune in to, at a particular time. And it's like, well, bro, there's freaking archives.
That's right. It's a new world now, and they're going to be up there for a long, long time, too. So yeah. Tell your friends about Vinny's show. Tell your friends about my show. And while Vinny and I have got a chance, I want to give a big shout-out and thank you to all the hardworking people at AmericanFreedomRadio.com for helping to raise the voice of freedom and doing the amazing job that they do and making it fun for us to bring to you quality programming.
Yeah, yeah, and then that's another thing that's really, really difficult in this day and age is actually funding yourself and keeping everything actually on an even keel as it is. You know, it's hard work getting all this material out there, and often it's without many forms of monetary reward. You kind of have to create those yourself, which is one thing that we've been doing. Over here in New Zealand, like I go out to public meetings and get donations and give people my DVDs in exchange. And what I've been really kind of thinking about in recent times is that, well, this is not an isolated case. You know, all truth is anywhere. If you want to get the truth out, it's very expensive and sometimes, you know, non-rewarding.
Well, what I do is that I go down to the nursing home on Viagra night. And I pick up a few bucks that way, so it helps.
As you do. Well, and this goes into another point, is that dabbling in drugs or whatever the hell, you know.
Caught you off guard with that one, didn't I, huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Marijuana is a gateway drug to Vicodin.
Right. No, right. Viagra night. I go down and pimp myself out at the nursing home and pick, you know, like a little hooker and, you know, make 20 or 30 bucks and apply it to the Time for Hemp broadcast. Truth is, yeah, and when you're dealing with this type of topic, whether it be marijuana or the other things that we do bring to you at American Freedom Radio, it's difficult to find a lot of people who have the kahunas to stand by us in advertising dollars. Now, if Vinny had a program that was about abortion or anything along those lines, whether it be pro-abortion or anti-abortion, there'd be corporate funding, people standing up alongside the street, handing him money as he came into work each day. And it would be one of the, everybody would love it. But when we're talking about marijuana, whether it be on my show or the things that Vinny covers on his, people kind of like, kind of shy away because they're afraid they're going to end up on a list someplace. And those who can afford to advertise don't. And those who want to advertise on your program can't afford it. So it is very frustrating at times being an activist of this nature.
Well, yeah, that's the reason why activism has been kept down for so long.
Well, it's just a matter of the corporate interests serving themselves, and then, you know, by way of their influence, shutting down dissent that could damage their market opportunities for a start, and then their power, the power that spreads from that. But I mean,
because I could raise my income level 12 times just by stop being a disc jockey on Time for Hemp and just go on welfare.
Talking about other things, yeah.
Well, I could quit my little job and go on welfare and probably earn more money just because of the topic of marijuana. People are so afraid, you know. And like I said, those who do advertise, they don't have the big budgets like Coper, like Procter & Gamble or the people who own Zest and all that garbage. So, yeah, it's frustrating. Very frustrating.
Yeah, my opinion is if nobody's going to support you, I'm just doing it anyway. You know, nothing can freaking stop me. I don't need anybody else in order to do stuff. I mean, if anybody else helped me, it would only improve what I'm doing. It doesn't mean that if they stopped helping me, I would stop doing what I'm doing.
And that's where I was at when American Freedom Radio came along. As I shared at the top of the hour, I was originally doing my own podcast each week. I didn't give a darn if anybody was advertising me or not or whatever. I just did it. I called up Keith Stroff. I called up Marnie Frank. I edited the interviews myself. I dropped in my own music. I loaded them up on the site and promoted the hell out of them. Thank you very much. I don't care. I'm going to do it whether I have help or not. And then along came American Freedom Radio, and not only did they help, but they brought a larger audience to the truth. And it was just a big change. And I was very grateful that that happened. And so you're right. There's not a lot of people like American Freedom Radio out there. We're grateful for the few that are. But we do encourage more to join us, huh?
Well, thank you very much, Casper, for coming on the show with us today. It's been a real pleasure, mate. One thing I'd really like to say, have you got any parting words for our fabulous audience here at the Vinnie Eastwood Show?
Yeah, do it. As long as you're sitting there watching TV and trying to figure out who's going to win Dancing on the Stars or New Zealand Idol and eating a Twinkie, then I got news for you. You are part of the problem. But as soon as you get up and get part of an organization or start getting active in your community, then you become part of the solution. So get up, get busy, and take Time for Hemp.
That's right. Thanks, Casper. And ladies and gentlemen, it's very true what he says, is that if you get up and you do something, you are automatically part of the solution by default. And we've got a saying here at the Vinnie Eastwood Show, me and my somewhat fabulous producer, I'm doing it any effing way. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, where you can check out our fabulous archives of the amazing guests that we've had on our show, like Casper Leach, of course. And we will be right back with the second hour after this short break. Back in a moment. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's unconventional news. And we do like to try and fill up the schedule with amazing guests, some of which you may have never heard from, but I would wager all of which you'd want to hear from again. On that note, we have a very special guest. His name is Stefan Molyneux, is it, bro?
From Canada. Molyneux, that's pretty good, yeah.
Molyneux, okay, and he's coming at us from Canada. He's the host of Free Domain Radio, and just in this short segment here, I'd love to get him to introduce himself to y'all. Stefan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Vinny. It's very nice to be. I feel like we're drilling through the center of the earth from one colony to another and launching sound packets at each other. So I think that's pretty cool. I run Free Domain Radio. It's the largest and most popular philosophy show on the web at freedomainradio.com. We've had about, 26, 27 million downloads by now. I've been doing it full time for a couple of years and part time before that. I used to be a software executive. Before that, I was a graduate student studying history, and before that, I did some acting at the National Theatre School of Canada, and before that, we fade into the midst of inconsequential high school experiences, so I won't bore everyone with those. I am a rationalist, I guess you could say. I work from first principles and evidence, and I'm fascinated by economics, particularly Austrian economics. I like to apply philosophical principles to society, to politics, to relationships, to marriages, to parent-child interactions. I'm just fascinated to the degree to which universality, you know, the wonderful universalization that philosophy is capable of, the degree to which it can be extended, expanded, and injected into just about every form of human interaction, both external and also internal with yourself. So that's my particular bent, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah, well, and this is the thing. We just had Casper Leach on from Time for Hemp, and it seems to me that it's intelligent, professional people, for some reason, get motivated to stop working in that particular environment and start working on a personal project for the benefit of the rest of the population. And there's usually some description of motivating factor behind that. For myself, it was being arrested for dealing cannabis, and that really kind of woke me up. What happened to you?
What happened to me? It says, like, what injury did you sustain that turned you into a philosopher? Well, that may be actually a pretty good question. Well, I mean, I think I came through a pretty traditional route. I got turned on to objectivism when I was in my mid-teens and studied that and branched out from there, became a big fan of Aristotle and Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and other of the sort of great philosophers. And like most people, you know, you immerse yourself in a study for about 20 years off and on, and then you begin to want to bring some of yourself to it. You know, like you can play other people's piano music for so long, and after a while you want to start singing or creating tunes yourself. And that was my particular goal, so that's what I've been up to.
All right, awesome. Stefan Molyneux, host of Free Domain Radio, ladies and gentlemen, here on American Freedom Radio on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. We'll be right back after this short break with our fabulous guests. Back in a moment. Show. Oh, wait, hold on a second.
And welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. It's the Godfather episode with the man himself, Stefan Molyneux, coming to us live from Canada. Stefan, welcome back.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I feel I should kiss a ring or something, but I guess we'll just have to keep moving on.
You only get one favor.
Speaking of favors, would you do me a favor and talk about the Middle East situation? Because I'm very interested to hear what you have to say. And just to preface it, in fact, it doesn't even need prefacing. If you are listening to this show, you already know that there is copious quantities of crap happening in the Middle East right now. Stefan, go for it, my friend.
Well, I think the first thing to recognize about the Middle East is that these activists have internet access. And given that they have internet access, they're looking at something that we in the West aren't really looking at nearly as much as we should, which is the greatest, most massive, most stupendous elevation of the poor into the middle class that has ever before been seen in history. Over the past 20, 25 years in India and in China, over 300 million people have escaped poverty, because the Chinese economy has been growing at like 9.5% per year. I mean, it's staggering, because they've actually allowed entrepreneurs to be free, and they have a smaller share. The government has a smaller share of the Chinese economy than the British government does, which is supposed to be all kinds of capitalist, right? And so Egypt in particular, you have 40% of the population living on less than $2 a day. This is after 6,000 years of statism. This is the best they've been able to achieve. And so I think a factor of three things. One is this continual poverty in the Middle East, which is just grueling and absolutely brutal. The second is, of course, the middle-class people are able to see the amount of opportunity that is available in other formerly third-world countries like China and like India, and want the same thing. And they recognize, they understand that it's economic freedom, as it always is, which has vaulted all of these people out of this hand-to-mouth, poverty-eat-your-toenails existence. And I think third, of course, you've had a massive increase in the price of foodstuffs over the past couple of months, 20-30%, depending on how you count it, and sometimes even more. And when you're living on $2 a day and your price of your food goes up 30%, you're just 30% hungrier. And I think that's fascinating. I think what's also has been mentioned a little bit, but not very much in the mainstream media, is the intelligence community around the world. I mean, good Lord. I mean, they were caught off guard by the Iranian Revolution in 78, India's 98 nuclear tests. They failed to foresee the 9/11 attacks in the U.S. Didn't even see the end of the Cold War. They were examining the most examined country in the world, which was Iraq in the 90s, and they thought there were weapons of mass destruction that they weren't. They missed the fall of the Berlin Wall. They missed the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968. They missed the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. They had no idea the 1973 Yom Kippur War was going on. They miscalculated all of the Bay of Pigs stuff. I mean, you could go on, and Lord knows I've been known to, but I think it's really important for people to recognize that this is like really sad and pitiful state radar. These people are paid hundreds of billions of dollars a year to suss out all of the potential trouble spots around the world. They missed the uprisings in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt. They have no idea what's going on. They lack human intelligence. They seem to lack basic intelligence. They seem to lack internet access. I mean, the chat rooms in the Arab world were alive with revolutionary talk. There were Twitter feeds going up all over the place. Facebook pages exploding with organization. And these people are like, I don't know. I'll check some guy's blog maybe and see if anything's going on. I don't know what they do all day. But I just thought not only is there a lot of very interesting factors going on to generate, I think, some potential for positive changes in the Middle East, but it is also just another massive internal security and intelligence failure on the part of all of the U.S. alphabet soup of agencies that are supposedly designed to protect everyone.
Well, you know, the revolutionary aspect of what's going on in the Middle East is not a unexpected element. I mean, the U.S. government has known for some time that the dictators that they sponsor are really ticking off the people of the Middle East, and eventually they would be overthrown. And so they've seen this kind of well in advance, apparently, and now it seems to be just sort of positioning themselves so that there's a crisis in the Middle East to force up food prices so that the instability will then affect the rest of the world, and use that as a justification for people to beg for martial law. And that's my opinion, at least.
So you think that there may be sort of martial law and a further crackdown in the Middle East?
Well, I'm talking more along the lines of the Western world. I mean, martial law really basically, in my opinion, can't be implemented in the Middle East because there's just too many people that are on the streets. You know, you can't marshal an entire population if the entire population is motivated against you. It just can't happen. Unless, of course, you have more guns than the entire population does and are prepared to use them on unarmed populations, as is happening in Libya, where, incidentally, U.S. troops have now landed in order to train the rebels. So, you know, we're going to be looking at yet another U.S. war.
Yes, yes. Well, you really can't get enough of those on your Cheerios every morning, can you?
Absolutely not. You know, I mean, I've got my bowl of U.S. wars as well, like that, you know, and a few teaspoons of that on my cornflakes every morning just keeps me damn skippy.
Tastes like cordite. But look, I mean, you're from New Zealand, right?
It's like depleted uranium that I can sprinkle, you know.
But look, you're from New Zealand, right? So, I mean, New Zealand in the 90s went through a significant contraction in the size and scope of state power, right? I mean, ditched a whole bunch of subsidies, got rid of, I think, almost all the agricultural subsidies. There were, I think, drops in the corporate tax rates and shrinking in state expenditures. So that there are certain times, I mean, the state as a whole generally expands, but it's sort of a jagged line. And so there are times when the state is going to contract. My particular view is that in the Western world, there is going to be a contraction in the state over the next sort of 5 to 10 years. I think that's inevitable. I think the ruling class is not ready to give up because there's no particular place for them to go. You know, it was one thing for the ruling classes or the banking classes or the elite classes to flee from, you know, 18th century or 19th century Europe to the New World. But I don't think they really want to learn Mandarin, so there's not a whole lot of places for them to go. Though I think they're going to stand in the West, and I think we're going to see some restoration of economic freedoms, probably not as many social freedoms, but some economic freedoms, because they understand that the tax livestock have become unproductive because the walls of regulation and taxation and control have closed in a little too tightly. You know, if you pack your cows too close together, they just get sick and die. And so the economy in the West, this to me is as much Europe as it is North America, a little bit more so than in America than Canada. But there's been too much regulation, too much control, too much expansion of state power, too many dependent parasites on state power. This is going to have to be a reform. I don't think it's going to fall into fascism, because the ruling classes know that way lies their own impoverishment in the long run, that they need to loosen the shackles on their productive classes in order to restore some of the economic growth that has died off over the past 20 or 30 years.
Where I focus a lot of my time, and in fact, no, I don't focus too much on it, come to think of it, but the extermination aspect of New World Order and those sorts of things are always in the back of my mind. You know, whenever any kind of war, conflict, or any type of event that gets hyped up in international media, I automatically, and this is probably just my assumption, my young ignorance working here, but my assumption always is, okay, who's benefiting from this, and how is it going to be used to further take our freedoms off us, expand state power, and eventually exterminate us orderly?
Well, I mean, it's always a possibility, but as you may know, I view the relationship between the rulers and the citizens as the relationship between a farmer and the livestock. And we are sort of in the unique position as livestock that we only tend to be productive when we perceive that we are free and respect it. And that, of course, is a counter to being livestock, but nonetheless, it's sort of the double thing that we require. Farmers don't want to kill off all their livestock. They want to find ways to make them more productive. Unfortunately, one of the things that's happened over the past, a couple of centuries, really, but it's really been focused since the 1960s, is that the politicians have bought votes by selling off the future of the productive classes. In other words, the productive entrepreneurial classes. They've bought votes by taking money from the productive classes and shoveling it down the gullets of people who become increasingly dependent. And I don't just mean the poor. I also mean the military-industrial complex, the corporations who suckle at the state teats and so on, and the bankers, of course. And so governments take from the productive class and give to other people in return for votes, because it's a lot easier to get money from the government than it is to go out and rob someone yourself. It's a lot safer, I guess, for people who aren't so much into the knife in people's ribs scenario.
It reminds me of the plaque that Ron Paul has on his desk. No stealing. This government doesn't like competition.
Competition, right. No counterfeiting, because that's our job, right? So I think that what's happened is the dependent classes, you know, there's been a whole series of governments that have needed to create more and more dependencies, because that's how they buy their votes. And this is true of public sector unions, and as I said, the financial classes, the bankers, Wall Street, military-industrial complex, the military itself, the prison complex, and you could go on and on. But there's just way, way, way too many anchors hanging off this boat, and there's way too many parasites in this body. And so there's going to need to be a shift away from this, quote, redistribution of money, which is just theft and bribery. There's going to need to be a shift away from it. I don't think that the rulers are so dumb as to think that if they just impose martial law and fascism that they're going to do anything other than completely crater the economy, because they'll have to prevent people from leaving. And when people are prevented from leaving and martial law is declared, they tend to become economically very unproductive. You end up with a kind of late Mussolini slash Brezhnev-style economy, or a Chairman Mao economy, where people aren't producing anything because they're just too depressed. And so you have to keep the illusion of freedom alive. But at the same time, you have to, you know, draw back or cut back on the amount of money that's going to the dependent classes. It's a tricky, tricky business, but I bet your heads are working very hard in the corridors of power to figure out how to achieve this end.
Like you said,
or how to stop people from finding any solutions. Go, Will.
I mean, you touched on something there. I mean, a lot of this policy of, especially of welfare-based initiatives, is just vote-grabbing. You know, sure. It's just pragmatic. You haven't got enough money. You can't afford the food. We're going to give you some food stamps. We're going to give you $60 a week. And there's all the promises. We're going to make free education. You know, who cares if we're brainwashing you? You know, there's no, where have people's principles gone? Why don't they think beyond the first dimension instead of just thinking money from government equals good, I vote for them? You know, like,
right.
You know, where's the actual, nothing's free in this world. The government can't create anything out of nothing. Well, the bankers can. you know what I mean? They're not actually thinking about the downstream effects. If something seems too good to be true, it always is.
Oh, yeah, it's easy to win a game if you cheat.
Well, but the brilliant thing about creating this dependent class is that they become the social police of everyone else, right? So if you live next door to some, I mean, not to pick on anyone in particular, there's these Wisconsin teachers at the moment whose salaries are significantly higher with benefits than the average Wisconsin's. So you live next door to someone who's a teacher who's, you know, benefiting from all of this state control and coercion. They get a couple of months off in the summer. They finish work at 2:30. They're in. And so what happens is if you say, look, I want to be free. I want to be free of the violence of taxation. I want to be free of the destructiveness of state power. What happens is they get mad at you. So the government doesn't have to send anyone around to your house and threaten you with anything. All they have to do is create a dependent class that's big enough that the moment any of the productive classes starts talking about freedom, all the dependent classes start shouting them down. And it's a beautiful mechanism that keeps the slaves self-policing, right? The state is fundamentally a horizontal mechanism of slave-on-slave aggression. It's very rare that it needs to be top-down. We all just turn on each other when anybody threatens the withdrawal of state benefits.
Exactly.
And it's said.
Exactly. You see, if you go out on the street and you demonstrate for 9/11 truth or anything that's outside the box, who comes running to the defense of the establishment? Well, they don't need Henry Kissinger down there on the street because they've got every brainwashed little SOB out there who thinks they're part of the establishment, who thinks it works for them, who thinks that, you know, the Diet Coke is wholesome and good for them. And they come running to the defense of the system they don't understand, except for the trickle-fed, you know, what they get fed over the media, portholes. It's really sad, isn't it? Your own flesh and blood. I've got extended family who will defend a system they know nothing about to the point where they won't talk to me. They can't even give me the time of day being flesh and blood related.
Right.
It's
no,
amazing.
That's
how powerful propaganda is. And it's not a sob story, but it happens to anyone who steps outside the mark, because that's how powerful the propaganda is, worth more now than DNA.
And the sad thing, too, is that I think there's a lot of shame in being part of the dependent class. And along with a lot of shame comes a lot of fear, which is that you've kind of specialized as a sort of economic organism. You've kind of specialized into being this, fitting into this particular slot of dependency. And if society changes, I think it makes people feel very insecure that they're going to have to go out and compete in the free market with people who are, you know, maybe more ambitious or maybe harder working and so on. So people, I think, feel a sense of shame and dependency. I think we all know what's going on deep down. But I think there's also a sense of great fear. And I think of somebody, you know, with all due sympathy, right? So some teacher who's 60, who's worked for, you know, 30 years or whatever as a teacher, and, you know, she's needs her retirement and she needs her health benefits and so on. And people come along and say, well, you know, this is all kind of coercive and it's all kind of immoral and so on. I mean, that's a pretty terrifying thing. She can't rewind and start all over, and she can't even fast forward and start all over. So I have a lot of sympathy for the people who have fallen into these sort of jaws of these kind of propaganda, have their brain chewed up and sort of spat out, and are in the situation where they really do have a pretty grim battle on their hands. It's very, very hard to face that and to realize that you've been dependent, to realize that the system that's been supporting you and is going to support you has some pretty significant ethical problems at its very root, notably the violation of the non-aggression principle. So, you know, it's hard for people to admit that kind of stuff.
Mm-mm. And swinging back into the Middle East situation, we have, how many countries now are on the verge of overthrowing or already have overthrown their government? You know, we're talking about a thing that's region-wide. We've got Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Yemen, Egypt, Tunisia, Libya. I mean, where's it going to stop? I mean, that's just counting off the top of my head. That's seven.
Right. Well, I think these things do tend to snowball, and there is this incredible, the very reason that we're talking ourselves, this is incredible spider web of communication that is going on. That people in you know, I mean, this guy sets himself on fire in Tunisia, and everybody in the Arab world knows about it within 6 hours, and can, you know, maybe even see the video if there was video, or hear the reports, or see the news stories. And I mean, that is completely mind blowing. That you can see this revolution spreading digitally and visually. It's truly astounding.
Absolutely. The grand thing about being in the information age is that you give the average person the ability to amplify their emotions, their thoughts, and their experiences. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, our very special guest, is Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain Radio, and we'll be right back after the break. That's it. Ladies and gentlemen, the evil scumbags and elites and whatnot that think that this planet is their frickin' ordained right to rule, there is nowhere to run and nowhere to hide because, well, they're surrounded on all sides by their enemies of free humanity. Our very special guest joining us for this hour is Stefan Molyneux, the host of Free Domain Radio. Stefan, welcome back.
Thanks, Vinny. Great to be here.
Yeah. Hey, well, what was the thing that we wanted to get into now with them? Well, just sort of like solutions and philosophically how we can actually turn this system around, because what's happened is that we've got a society now that's been socially engineered into basically just not giving an F about the things that rule their lives. What if it's absolutely mad?
Well, I mean, it's you could say that it's a rational calculation, right? So why, you know, I don't spend my spare time looking at, you know, mangled bodies in surgery manuals, because, you know, there's not much time, I'm not going to be a surgeon. So I think a lot of people who don't feel like or believe that they have the ability to make a change are not going to look into what the problems are, because then it's just like researching stuff you can't do anything about. It's going to depress you. It's going to alienate you. It's going to make conversations with other people all kinds of awkward, because they're going to bring up, you know, how, well, we should raise corporate taxes to do this, and we should lower spending over here. And of course, if you disagree with the whole system, those conversations can be a little bit awkward. So if you say to people, well, you should learn about this stuff, you should learn philosophy, and you should learn freedom, and you should learn economics, and part of them will say, so that I can feel excluded, so that I can feel awkward, so that I can have really, really, really explosive conversations with people, in order to achieve what? And I think that's the great gap that the freedom movement has yet to close, which is to give people a compelling reason for learning about stuff which can be brain tortuous and make you feel a whole cavalcade of despair and hopelessness and all other kinds of things.
Exactly. That's why I mean, activists who basically adopt very specific fields of research, you know, so that they can understand one element. And my goal is really to just sort of interview all the people who are specialists in all the elements, so that I can be given at least a general overview, so that I can personally, for myself, just figure out what the hell is going on here and what to do about it.
My goal is to defeat these guys, and so we don't have to do this show anymore, to be honest.
Because we need to get out, right?
No, well, I mean, it's more than the show that we need to. The show isn't our predicament, you know. The total enslavement is, and that's what I think is missing. I think we need a reference plane, a backbone, a skeleton to our resistance from which we're working from. Otherwise, we're just, you know, getting paddled off at every argument, at every level. We're getting pushed to the side with pragmatic debates. Oh, we needed to invade Iraq because we've got this Islamic hatred towards the West, and they're jealous of our way of life. They're jealous of our slavery. They want they want interest.
Yeah, we kill millions of them by denying them food and medical care, and then we're shocked that they might be at all upset with us. I mean,
but unless we have a real reference plane that everyone can agree on, then we cannot defeat all their little pompous arguments that we know ahead of time they're going to say it. Then we know they're going to call us conspiracy theorists. We know they're going to say this isn't the time for debate and all the rest.
You're an extremist.
Yeah, like, you know,
because that's a helpful word, right?
The View the other day, and then you know, the View's talking about Charlie Sheen, and you can't mention anything about the geopolitical nature of what's going on, what America's doing right now, because that's, you know, that's outside of the frames of the debate as we've you know, pictured it.
Is the debate actually important anymore? I think the frame of the debate, it seems to be more important than the topic of the debate itself. You know, I think that debate should be able to have free flow and be able to go into any direction that is in any way relevant, you know, because some people, they try to separate things. And this is the great part about compartmentalized society, where everybody's specialized in one small area and can't do F all else. You know, they just block themselves off from learning things because they just don't see the relevance, or they don't want to see it more operatively.
Well, I've always felt that, I shouldn't say I've always felt, I've really come to the conclusion over the last few years, gentlemen, that the fact that you can't have these conversations with people is exactly why we don't need a government. Because these social rules are spontaneously created. There's no central directive, right? Like your socialist Aunt Ellie doesn't get a little directive which says, okay, if this topic comes up, you need to block with this. And if this topic comes up, you need to say this. And don't even talk about
this
topic. Yeah. Well, these rules, these ostracisms, these tensions, these social problems, these attacks, they all arise spontaneously. In other words, the most fundamental social rules of interaction are arising spontaneously, are enforced without any central coordination or planning. And that is a fantastic argument as to how social rules can be enforced without a government. Just try to talk to people outside the box of propaganda, and you get short circuits, you get aggression, you get pretend confusion, you get all of these things which we've all experienced a million times. But that's exactly why we don't need a government, because all of these social rules will be enforced without central planning, without central coercion, without all of these mechanisms which are so destructive, like jails and wars and imprisonments and so on. I think it's a really, although it can be really frustrating to work within this really foggy maze of social convention, the fact that it's so powerful is exactly the argument that should help propel us forward, which is to say, hey, you know how you don't want to talk about this, or, you know, I can predict exactly what you're going to say when I bring up taxation is force. You're going to tell me it's a social contract. If I say it's a social contract, then it should be voluntary. You say, no, it has to be enforced, because if it wasn't enforced, no one would obey it. So then it can't be a social contract, because nobody wants to obey it, and therefore it's force. I know we're going to go round and round like this. It's completely predictable. But that's exactly why we don't need a government, because people will spontaneously organize themselves to protect the status quo, to protect their self-interest. All we have to do is teach them that their self-interest is different than what their masters tell us, and society will self-organize and enforce itself without the need for centrally coercive monopolies of power.
Yeah, decentralizing government, I think, is one of the things that I really, really want to advocate here, is because of the fact that every single centrally planned economy has eventually either deprived all its people of its wealth or assets, or destroyed all of their rights. You know, it doesn't work any other way if you look at history. And my assumption is that at the moment, our politicians, for some reason, they are so brainwashed and they are so propagandized. I would hasten to guess that even very few of our current politicians know anything about politics, geopolitics, or the New World Order, or any of these aspects that would actually influence their political decisions. They don't know. And it's because of the fact that we don't debate all of these things. It's because of the fact that they operate within set guidelines and paradigms. And it's because of the fact that they can't talk about truth.
No, they can't. And if you imagine the most staggeringly narcissistic vanity that it must take for a politician to say, I am competent to talk about how education should work in a country of 300 million people, or 15 million, or 5 million people. I mean, just imagine how insane you would have to be at the very, very deepest level. So insane that you look perfectly normal. How insane you'd have to be to say, I know how to create jobs in a complex, technological, modern economy that is embedded in globalization. In other words, I know how to create jobs. I saw this guy in The Daily Show the other day, who was one of Barack Obama's top economic advisors. And he was like, you know, we've created a million jobs over the thing. No, you haven't. You haven't done it. You've borrowed. You've sold off the kids to whoever, but you haven't created a single job, because if you were creating a single job, you'd be too busy actually working for a living rather than writing all these policy statements. But that's the thing that's amazing. Philosophy really is, I think, fundamentally designed to teach you humility. I don't know how the poor should be saved. I don't know how everyone should be educated. I don't know how national defense should be provided. I don't know how roads should be built. I do believe that if we stop pointing guns at everyone all the time, amazing and wonderful solutions will come out of the complex ecosystem of human creativity. But I don't know. This is anarchism or voluntarism or statelessness or whatever you want to call it, is simply an admission of rational ignorance. I don't know how you should live. I don't know what your wife should do with her life. I don't know exactly how your children should be educated. I don't, like, even one family I can't tell how to live. But the idea that you can pass a law to tell 300 million people how their healthcare should be provided, I mean, that is so mad that you know these people have never gone through this sort of humility of rational self-limitation or rational self-examination.
Exactly. I mean, instead of saying, I don't know, and being honest and open about it, they say instead another three words, I don't care.
What do you mean?
I mean, what happens is these people don't want to think of – they don't want to go and read 25 books and study – social policy or just anything, or just even just think for themselves. I sit in a dark room at night and go, what makes sense here? How do I want to live my life? How does my neighbor want to live my life? What sort of intent do most people have? What are threats to our liberty? Instead of thinking these things, people just go, well, I'm going to trust Barack Obama. He looks like a nice man. He's smart. He came out of Harvard Law. He got his first job with Zbigniew Brzezinski or whatever. I mean, he's a good guy. And so they offer up their trust, and that way these people get all this power. And then the same zombies say to me every day, and they say to you, Stefan, they say, you can't do anything about it. It's too big. You're just a drop in the water. Quit while you're ahead. Stop hating the government. Don't blame them for your problems.
Well, sorry, let me interrupt you for just a sec. I would be a little bit more precise. They don't give up their power to Barack Obama. I mean, it's no reason to pick on him rather than anyone else, but his name came up. Because if they wanted to give up their power to Barack Obama, he wouldn't even need to run for office, right? He would just need to create a website where he would tell people what to do every day, and they just go and subscribe, and he'd say, okay, well, I need to give my money here, and I need to go obey these rules, and so I'll just go and do that.
What yeah, happens I want is to the be power Barack is taken, yeah, the power is taken from
them. Yeah, the power is taken from them. Sorry, the power is taken from them, and then they justify it by saying, well, he seems like a nice, smart guy, so I guess it's okay.
Yeah. Sorry. I mean, I labeled it. I pinned it on Barack. What I should say is it's not the figurehead. It's the establishment that they whore themselves out to for cheap rates, comparative to the national debt anyway. And, it's what it does is it alleviates people of their own responsibilities for themselves. So it's not that most people are bad. It's just that as these catch nets have been developed, and we have all this entertainment industry, and then we're working more and more slavishly because our dollar's been devalued, people don't have the time or energy or motivation or inclination to really want to govern themselves. And so these guys are given the opportunity to step in, because government has no power on paper. Government is a fictional entity. The only way they get power is by people conceding their own, and that's the sad thing.
Realize
your personal power. If you think about the might of the biggest armies in the world, the U.S. military today, you think of their power, and you think of all of what they have, and you just look at the architecture of government. All that power is stolen power. That's all the initiative and all the drive and the intellect that's stolen from people and disproportionately placed in few hands to be a baton tool of the central bankers who go unseen.
I think it's very true that you don't ever see the guys behind the curtain. I mean, Barack Obama doesn't wield the power. It's the people who print the money and the people who control the currency, in my view, who have the real power.
So it's exactly.
It's the least obvious ones, I mean, and they're so detached from reality that, it wouldn't surprise me, but of course it would shock me if, say, a congressman or whatever kidnapped 100,000 children and then forced them into prostitution and said, look at all the jobs that I've created.
So as a solution, that's what you would do. You would say, we're not going to serve central banks anymore, and we're going to, nationalize our banks and cancel the debt? Is that the first step you would take?
Well, the first step that I would take is simply allow for a free market in currency. I mean, this is how it used to work in the United States and in other countries. Because, of course, it used to be gold and silver back in the day, and fiat currency was simply created as a representation of gold and silver. It was never supposed to have any value in and of itself. It was certainly never supposed to have any value outside of its relationship to gold and silver. And the free market in general tends to pick, or at least used to when it was free, tended to pick gold and silver because, you know, it had good ratios. It was hard to find. You could split it up without destroying its value, unlike something like a diamond or whatever. And so I would simply say...
And even then they manipulated the value.
There were some changes in the value because, for instance, when Spain discovered the New World, they imported all of this gold, which messed up their economy and gave them 400 years of economic decline because of massive inflation. And so there are problems with gold and silver as a form of currency. I think that electronic currency would be much better. But currency as a whole needs to be very closely and rationally tied to the overall growth of the economy. And anybody who runs a private currency system that could provide stability and predictability in that currency without deflation, without wild boom and bust swings, would very quickly rise to prominence in the economy. So the very first thing that I would do, of course, cancel all the debt. The debt is completely and totally imaginary. But privatize money.
Yeah. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show. Our very special guest is Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain Radio. And we'll be right back after the break. Back in a moment. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnyEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. Our very special guest, Stefan Molyneux, host of Free Domain Radio, joins us here for the final segment of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. Now, one thing I'd like to get your take on is we were discussing over the break the concept of freedom or constitutionality and whether or not it can even be maintained because, in my opinion, and we take the example of Hugo Chavez, for example, when he was elected, he made a point of going around and teaching the people of Venezuela about their rights and their constitution and yada, 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 making sure that they all knew it. And then after the CIA ousted him in a coup, 2 million people took to the streets, overthrew the coup leaders, and then brought Chavez back. Now, that seems as a shining example of what happens when you educate people about what their rights are and how important it is to defend them. And this has been eroded by a number of different mechanisms in the United States, both chemically, politically, and monetarily, to basically take away people's knowledge of their rights and thus take away the rights themselves. What's your take on that, Stefan?
Well, I'm annoyingly philosophical in these areas. So I don't like to look at, you know, what may work, what could have worked, what has worked here, what has worked there, because what I like to do is say, okay, well, look, we need to have some way that society needs to be organized. I think that organization is a pretty good thing. I mean, you need stuff to work in society, and I think that's a good thing to aim for. And so we're either going to try and patch stuff together based on what we kind of like or what might have worked here or could have worked there, or what we're going to do is we're going to clear the table. And clear the table, we're going to say, okay, what's good and what's evil? What's right, morally right, and what's morally wrong? And I think that we all agree that theft is wrong, that assault is wrong, that murder is wrong, that rape is wrong.
Okay, which all straight away here we get into... Straight away, yeah, here we get into a moral, a system of morality. The Zeitgeist crowd would argue there is no inherent morality. It's all conditioning.
Right.
So what do we do with those people? I mean, there's a lot of people.
Well,
it's not
see,
the Zeitgeist
but here's
people.
The thing. I mean, I've got a whole book on ethics, which is available for free on my website, where I sort of try and make this case. I won't make the whole case here. But if we accept that the non-aggression principle, and I've talked to the Zeitgeist people, I had a debate with them recently, and they agree that the non-initiation of force is a moral principle, that they would not initiate force to get their system going, in which case we're all brothers experimenting in the social paradise called everyone. That's great. But if we accept that the non-initiation of force is a universal value, then simply by definition, you simply can't have a government because a government is a monopoly, a group with a monopoly to initiate a monopoly power to initiate force in a geographical area. So if you're going to say that the non-initiation of force is a moral good, then you can't have a government. However tempting and however comfortable, and I understand how comfortable it is, and it's really weird to think of this as like thinking, hey, let's have a farm with no gravity. It seems weird to think of a society without government, but that's okay.
But okay. Right now we have total dependence, a total nanny state. You go your method here. I'm just posturing an argument here. Total independence. I'm saying people can't go from A to Z. I'm saying people go from A to maybe X, and we have a limited government where they have sole responsibilities, but their responsibilities have to and are held to the public good by a measure of moral good. And so it's not force. It's not force for their own benefit. It's an act of good and righteous government within the benefit of the people.
Well, but look, if you want to talk about practical consequences, here's what I would argue: that there's nothing more dangerous to the world than a small government, because a small government has a very efficient economy. And so if you look at England, why did it become a world power? Why did it ever have an empire? It had an empire because it was the first country to institute free trade and the protection of property rights, by and large, in general, for most of the classes. And so because of that, it became the world trade center of the world. Spain had a similar experiment in free trade, which gave them. So when you have a small government, the small government has a very productive economy. The very productive economy creates a huge influx of taxes or potential taxation, which allows the government to grow and grow and grow. So if you look at the American government, we were talking in the break, you said it worked pretty well for 80 years. Well, anarchism worked in Ireland for almost 1,000 years, but nonetheless, the government that starts off the smallest always ends up the largest, because the smallest governments have the most productive economies, which creates huge wealth, which they feed.
When we say Ireland's model worked, to what ends? I mean, not being mean here. I mean, I have ancestry in Ireland, but I mean, seriously, to what ends? Like, that comes down to cultural values. There's a lot of grey areas in right and wrong, and then it comes down to the physical on-the-ground application and the constituents of. Now, right now we have, for better or worse, largely cosmopolitan, multicultural nations where there are a lot of cultural boundaries clashing or distancing themselves from one another. It then favors your model of not having a centralized government, because that would have to have one-size-fits-all policy across all these cultural realms. But still, you're going to have tribal factions competing and then some rising to prominence over others. I mean, we're always going to have these boundaries form in society. We're always going to have a hierarchical system form, aren't we?
Well, I would argue that where you see the most tribal conflict is where you see people attempting to gain control of the state, right? So we think of the wars. Is to get foreign aid and other kinds of benefits.
You kind of broke up there a bit, Stefan. You'll have to repeat that.
Sure, sorry. So look at in Africa, you see all of these tribes that are competing and warring with each other. And what are they warring over? They're warring over to get control of the government, right? So that's what they're willing to invest blood and money into. They want power because there's already a government, right? So why did the Nazis invade France in May of 1940. They invaded France to take over the government, to take over tax base.
You can get rid of an official government, but you're always going to have people who want power, and whether you call it a government or a gang, these groups are always going to resist. My argument is if you have a good government, a good group of people, then they can act in the public good and protect the public from, you know, wannabe gangsters forming and ruling over people.
My thoughts is that you just need to inform the public so that they know how to defend themselves, because there's nothing more dangerous than somebody with independent thinking that won't do what you tell them to do. I'd like to thank you, Stefan, for coming on the show with us today. It's been a real pleasure, mate.
Thank you so much. It was a great conversation. Hey, I really appreciate the invitation.
Thank you, Stefan. We've got to have you back, Stefan. Thanks.
Take care, man. Have a great night.
Real. You can check him out on Free Domain Radio. Just Google that and you will find it. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Thank you very much for doing that, and we'll be back tomorrow.